Okay, welcome again, everybody. So today is the theme of the day is the theme is around sutta study, but the topic is on the on anatta, and everybody's done the readings, I'm sure. Okay, welcome everybody. It's nice to have so many people come, and we pick different topics and themes, and today is exploring suttas and seeing how the traditional teachings of the Buddha illustrate certain points of the teachings. And anatta, of course, is one of the it's one of the three characteristics of truth, reality, nature of existence, and it's also a distinguishing characteristic feature of the Buddhist teachings. And I must say, I pulled together all sorts of things as I was reading and studying, looking up things. And of course, one thing led to another, and I probably would have done better not doing anything. But how am I going to cover all this? How am I going to pull it all in so I don't miss anything? But in the end, it'll be what it is. But there is a wealth of material, and it really is such an important part of the Buddha's teachings, and that sense of anatta as not self. It's really important to make that distinction between not self and no self. There are Buddhists who kind of assert that the Buddha didn't, he taught a teaching of no self. There is no self. Get over it. But the teaching on anatta is it's part of his presentation of the middle way. And it's really, I think it's really helpful to see it in that, rather than some sort of doctrinal, rigid piece of philosophical dogma, that it's part of a middle way. Atta is, in the Pali language, self. So that sense of self, a solid self, soul, individuality that is fixed, and that carries on, is atta. That's a self, soul aspect. But the opposite of that is what's called viratta. And viratta is the negation of self. There is no self. And the Buddha taught a middle way of anatta, of not self, in the sense that whatever we conceive of as being self, solid, this individual entity, identity, is changing, is not solid, is not worthy of picking up as an identity or as a solid identity, because the identity is changing all the time. What we call ourselves one day is one thing. We wake up the next morning, it's all different. So that And the things that we, each aspect of what we identify with is just a something that is constantly changing. Body, feelings, a sense of pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, neutral feeling, you know, which one is, you know, will the real self please stand up? or, you know, perception, memory, that's constantly changing. Thoughts, emotions, views, constantly changing. Consciousness, even faster, changing. So that to pick up that as a self is problematic. It's going to create suffering. So that that's a so that the that use of anatta by the Buddha is a tool. There's only one discourse where the Buddha is actually questioned very directly and asked in point blank, is there a self or is there not a self? You know, if you know it, then tell me and be done with it. And the Buddha refused to answer. Said, this poor confused man, there's no point in answering because he's already locked into a position. It has to be either yes, it exists, or no, it doesn't exist. So the Buddha just thought, well, there's no point in answering. So the use of anatta as a teaching has to be put into its larger context of the means by which we can overcome suffering. When we can start to allow an understanding of what we experience in a context that we can see, experience, feel, and relinquish and let go. So that leads to an ending of suffering. The propping up of either an identity of this is my true self, or a negating of that's all rubbish. There is no self. Is another identity that we take on. So that the propping up of any identity is suffering. So does that mean that Buddhists are just wishy-washy, no identity people? So it's a you realize that what the Buddha is doing is giving that sense of a means by which we can address our experience and not create a problem around it. And there were a variety of suttas that we encouraged people to look at. And the first one was the Maharahula Vada Sutta, which is the greater exhortation to Rahula, and it's Machima 62. And what it is, Rahula, of course, is the Buddha's son, and the Buddha, his son is about, I think he's around 20 or something. I think he might have, 641, it's probably in the, he was already a young man at this point, because there are suttas where Okay. According to the commentary, the discourse was taught to Rahula when he was 18 years old, and so that kind of a young man coming into adulthood, his father, the Buddha, and as the commentary says, because what the discourse begins, then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Savatthi for alms. The Venerable Rahula also dressed, taking his bowl and outer robe, followed close behind the Blessed One. Then the Blessed One looked back and addressed the Venerable Rahula thus, Rahula, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all material form should be seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And then the Buddha goes on to, because Rahula asks, is it just the body or just material form? And then the Buddha goes on, oh, feeling, perception, formations, consciousness. And then in the sutta, then the Venerable Rahula considered thus, who would go into town for alms today when personally admonished by the Blessed One? And that's sort of a bit cryptic. And the commentary, how the commentary explains it, while Rahula was following the Buddha, he noted with admiration the physical perfection of the Buddha, of the Master, and reflected that he himself was of similar appearance. Think, you know, so, yeah, he's pretty good. I'm good. And then he said, I too am handsome like my father, the Blessed One. The Buddha's form is beautiful, and so too is mine. The Buddha read Rahula's thought and decided to admonish him at once before such vain thoughts led him into greater difficulties. Hence, the Buddha framed his advice in terms of contemplating the body as neither a self nor the possession of a self. So that's the back story to that. It's quite interesting. I mean, one, just that sense of the Buddha picking up on that, and the Buddha admonishing in a way that he could say his son would sort of, okay, watch those thoughts. This is one of the reasons why there's sometimes I know it, like in Ajahn Mun's biography, there are monks who left living with Ajahn Mun, this great sort of meditation master from Thailand, living with him because he would call people on their thoughts that they were having, and if you're living close to a teacher, and you say, it's embarrassing, you know, some of the stuff that goes through your mind, and you go, and he knows that, so there actually were monks who left. Because they were just a friend, and similar with Ajahn Chah, that's not beyond the capability, certainly, of the Buddha to have that kind of knowledge. But it's interesting that he goes straight to identification with self, in that sense. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And there is as we were discussing doing the preparation for this, our little committee of people, And you know, there's a kind of a question that comes up in the sense of why does the Buddha's meditation instruction to Rahula begin with anatta? In the sense that the uprooting of the conceit "I am" is something that comes up much later in the development of the path. It's sort of the path to arahantship. But the aspects of one reflection on self is also a doorway into understanding the sakkaya ditti, the identity view, what we create our identity around. And even though one doesn't relinquish the whole or the deep-rooted sense of I am, mana, still that insight or that ability to penetrate the way that we construct our sense of me and how we build it and build an identity out of form, feeling, perception, thought, consciousness is really the main doorway into the stream of the Dhamma, into the insight that would take one eventually to liberation, and it in and of itself is a huge shift between say putujana, which is the word for say a person, a world, one who is still how does Ajahn Jeff translate it? Sort of an ordinary, run-of-the-mill person. Putujana in the Pali language, it means someone who is still sort of kind of crusted over. Ajahn Jayasaro translates it, I mean, in jest or in lightly, as a thickie, somebody who's thick, still thick, and that penetration of that entry into the stream of Dhamma sheds a huge amount of the baggage that pulls one into the world constantly and into suffering. So this reflection, investigation on sakkaya ditti and as a doorway to liberation is a real kindness of the Buddha to point point anybody, but in this case, pointing his son picking that up and really investigating it, paying attention to it. There's a lovely discourse in the Amputrid. Because I say there's the possibility, say like in meditation, for the mind to become very peaceful, the mind to gain a certain tranquility and even a certain clarity, but as long as we don't direct attention to that understanding and relinquishing of that self-identity view, then as refined as the mind can be, it still keeps going to suffering. It still picks up the identity, body, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness as me. This is mine. This is who I am. And there's a discourse in the Anguttara Fours where the Buddha, of course, this is the Anguttara, so it's the numerical discourses, and the Buddha is saying there's four kinds of persons found existing in the world. Here, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in a certain peaceful liberation of mind. In that, there's the mind becomes peaceful, it becomes settled, and then he attends to this cessation of, in this, it's the way it's written is translated as personal existence, but it's that self-identification. It tends to the cessation of self-identification. As he's doing so, the mind does not leap up, grow confident, steadfast, or firm in the cessation of self-identification. For him, the cessation of self-identification is not to be expected. Just as if a man were to grasp a branch with his hand smeared with resin, his hand would stick to it, grip it, adhere to it. In the same way, a monk enters, blah, 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 into this attending to self-identification, and it's not expected. It's too much. Mind doesn't resonate with it. It actually becomes... oftentimes, what happens, the experience oftentimes is fear, and there are probably many meditators here who have felt that, where you're sitting, your mind's peaceful, it's clear, seems like it's going really well, and then there's an experience of that, and one could be directing attention to it even, and then. It's the reality sort of hits. Wow, there isn't. This is empty, but the mind doesn't leap up to it. It's fearful of it. So this is some. This is a really important piece of the in practice that one has to. Turn attention in a way that the mind actually does leap up, grow confident, grow steadfast and firm, because see, and this is why having the theory and understanding of anatta is so important. Again, that it's not an annihilation, and that it. And the identification with our experience and our creation of a sense of I and I am around things is inherently complicating and perpetuating suffering. So that it helps to have that theory, but when it gets to the experience of it, then one has to reflect and investigate. And pay attention to the ways that we can allow that experience to be present, and then to realize, oh, this is actually the way out, because it's like the mind is so used to. And that sense of self being a dominant feature of how we conceive of ourselves, that it's hard to look at it any other way. And of course, that's where, say, like sutta study is helpful, because you start realizing, oh, there's all sorts of reasons why this is really a good thing, because sometimes the mind kind of rebels against that, and say, even if it's true, accords with reality, well, I don't want it to be like that. But, of course, as long as we're arguing with reality, well, good luck. So it's a way that of being allowing that reality to establish itself. But that's where this sense, the mind leaps up, grows confident, steadfast, and because it's the image that the Buddha gives is with that you pick up a stick with resin on your hands, and it's your hand sticks to it, and that's what happens with experience. Whatever we grasp, hold through the sense experience, you know, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental formations, the mind sticks to it. And that is, say, the nature of clinging or grasping. But the opposite is true, and the mind leaps up, grows confident, and it's as if one grasps a branch with a clean hand. Just you pick it up, you put it down. You're not having to carry around all this extra baggage. So it's a means by which we can experience things. And it's like where Ajahn Chah sort of saying, there's only two things you need to do in practice that take you to the end of the goal of the path, knowing and letting go. And of course, as long as we have a sense of I and self that's sticky, you know it, and you stuff it here and carry it there, and you have this old sort of burden of me and mine and what we conceive of as myself. We carry that all as extra baggage. That gets complicated. Any questions? If that didn't stimulate some questions, I mean, I haven't been doing my duty. Yes, Neil.
To go back a bit.
Yeah.
I'm always curious about these commentaries, the commentators.
Yeah.
In most cases, haven't they produced these materials sometime after the Buddha's death?
Sure, yeah.
So I don't want to sound sacrilegious, but how do they know?
But they don't.
Stuff that's not in the suttas?
Well, there's a whole variety of things. The commentaries are... you know, sometimes you think, oh, these guys are just talking through their hats, making it up because it sounds like a good thing, or they haven't got anything better to do. But there's also a long tradition of commentaries that were carried on, you know, from shortly after the time of the Buddha, and that's one of the problems in the Theravada scriptures, which say like the Pali is acknowledged to be, you know, goes back to the time of the Buddha or shortly after. The commentaries. All of the various commentaries that had been collected were compiled and collated by one person, or probably with a group of people helping, and they put it into that form, and then all of the old texts or whatever was there was then destroyed, so that there is no way to sort out which is really old and which is new. So sometimes you have to take the commentaries with a grain of salt. Sometimes you take it and sort of, oh, that's interesting, that makes sense. And some are you know, have a real ring of sort of, you don't even really think about it. Sort of like, oh wow, yeah, that seems right. And but you know what its origin is hard to tell, impossible to tell. So that commentarial tradition is important to. And this is, in some circles, sacrilegious to say, where, you know, because, yeah, in some traditions, the commentaries are really sacrosanct. Thai tradition, Thai forest tradition, not so much. They're much. That's one of the beauties of coming from. Say this particular lineage is that there's much more emphasis put on the practical experience than on the texts themselves. It's more like, what can the text do to help you practice? Yeah, Irina.
So I have a question. You know how Buddha says, I'm not the body, the feeling, and the information consciousness?
Yeah.
So body is clear, feeling is more or less, but mental formation and consciousness, it's hard to go through the exercise of disidentifying with those when I don't really know what they are, or especially consciousness, like is it the sense of presence when all the thoughts are gone, and
consciousness is the actual knowing of the eye sees form, it sees a sight. There is the that contact, the coming together of those things. Consciousness forms a part of that process where it receives the sense data and recognizes it. It isn't the thinking, analyzing, or putting a label on it. It's just that ability to know. So it's a much more basic function, and it doesn't. It forms the basis of our ability to experience things, and then you can't really separate them out either. They have to work together. There's like the statement in the I think it's in Machima 44, the questions and answers with the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina, and say where she says, you know, these aspects are. Of the five khandhas are conjoined; they are not disjoined, and so that they're working together. But it's more like paying attention to function. So it's not something totally separate, but there is that aspect of function to be able to know. Okay, John.
I found that this piece by Ajahn Saro, I believe it is, about the types of questions that we ask.
Yes.
Useful. And I get the idea, you know, intellectually, that I think that this question of the self is sort of on the order of asking, how did the world start? Or is there a God? Or the kinds of questions that Buddha said don't further.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess they're in that same category. Questions that don't really have an answer or need to be answered.
Right.
But I can deal with those other issues at kind of a gut level, whereas this seems like a bigger stretch. But is that part of the process of beginning to come to grips? Because, you know, I mean, I know we all know that we can't tell a cop when we're pulled over that. And we're asked to show our license. Well, I don't really exist, and you can't give me a ticket, you know.
Yeah.
And then we have all sorts of self issues, you know, in our work lives and all that kind of thing. Okay. So I find as far as we're not always confronted with questions of is there a God or how did the world start, much easier to, let go of those kind of.
Right, and I think that what that again, it comes back to the point that the Buddha is not trying to make a categorical statement with the teaching of not self. What he's doing is trying to give you a strategy that allows you to look at what's more important, because the mind goes vacillates back. Do I exist? Do I not exist? Do I exist? Do I not exist? And I said, well. To be or not to be, that's not the question. it's more around, how do I deal with this? What's the effect of that? So then that aspect of this not-self is then giving us a way to loosen the grip around the feeling, because we experience something that is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, and we lock into it, or we have a memory that we then lock into, or a particular emotion that we then lock into, and then we invest that sense of self around it, and it gives us a strategy whereby we can loosen that and realize, because what it does is take us more easily back to, say, like the Four Noble Truths, rather than investing in a particular view of, I am or I am not.
Yeah. So it's kind of not a question of, he's not too interested in Western epistemology or something like that.
No. He's definitely not trying to. It really wouldn't work in that category. Yeah, Moria.
Are the skillful means for dealing with not self as easy as no and let go?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You just sort of, it's just, okay, knowing and letting go. Because it's then that we can start to, then you start to view it from that sense of, this is, what's the quality of that experience? Is it bringing me to wholesome states or unwholesome states? Is it fruitful or not fruitful? Does it give me a chance to plug into what's actually true or not? Yeah. Yes, Karen.
It kind of seems like just what I was hearing in this conversation, what came up for me was the phrase like, well, if I take this as myself, where does it lead me? Which that phrase has never really occurred to me before.
Yeah.
That seems helpful.
Yes.
When you're in a situation, if I take this as myself.
Yeah, where do I end up? And you just sort of, I end up suffering again. And that's the.
It does make it much more practical rather than some huge life question to be or not to be.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It's so much more helpful that way.
Exactly. And the Buddha's.
That teaches us.
Yeah. Yeah, and exactly. That's exactly what the Buddha is trying to give us, is to give us a tool to allow us to get around the sticky quality of me. And it's such a kindness.
I was thinking, I heard the teaching that usually if you watch your kilesas, at least in samadhi, they tend to subside. But sometimes you're watching your psychiatry and it's not going away.
Right.
At that point, would you want to look at the external circumstances?
Mm-hmm.
Or like, cause where is it coming from,
Yeah.
Or maybe other places too,
Yeah. Well, part of also is one of the ways and this is again where, say, like, anatta is intrinsically part of the experience or the characteristic of anicca and dukkha. So because sometimes to just look at the that feeling of self-identification or that the identity that we're picking up is just too sticky, or it's not, it's just so solid. But then, if we look at the aspect of impermanence, change, uncertainty, then it's a bit more tangible. Or the experience of dukkha, then it's a bit more tangible. And then you say, oh, but then because it's they're interwoven, then you can start to, you can come back to that sense of, oh, how's that identity being created?
So you're just shifting the perspective.
Shifting the perspective bit. Yeah.
Goes on to talk about the elements, right?
Yes.
And I don't know, are you going to go into that?
Probably.
Yeah. Well, then there are some
reasons. Okay. Okay, you can be patient. Tim.
Well, why go to all the trouble to teach us how to not have a self and then refuse to tell us there is no self?
It's not. He's not telling you don't have a self.
Well, let go of.
Yeah. Well, let go of what you're suffering with.
So it's narrowed to what you're viewing as self.
Yes.
Let go of those things.
Yes.
As being yourself.
Yes. Yes.
But he answered a lot of innocuous questions. I mean, many questions in the suttas aren't that relevant to enlightenment. Yet
yeah.
He pulled that out of his pocket and said, I won't answer this one.
Right. Right. Well, a lot of it is around the person who actually asks the question. Says it's around the person who asked the question. So that's part of it. But it's also, I mean, it is a kind of strategy, again, where the sidestepping the areas where we just end up endlessly complicating things.
So don't take the aggregates as yourself, or physical world as yourself and mind, and you won't suffer.
Yes.
But don't, it's not saying don't take anything as self.
Well,
it's not answering that. It's not
the thing is what else is there?
Well, yeah.
Because there isn't anything. Because the only thing you can experience is through body, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. And or when the Buddha says, what, you know, the world, what is the world? Sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch, tangible object, mental formations. That is the world. It's how we perceive and conceive of it. Edward.
I've seen this deductive approach toward understanding not self. Through looking at the aggregates, and it actually opens the door to a real intellectual understanding of it. So you're getting a sense, oh, you're right. Well, it's not my body, and so forth.
Yeah.
And then what I have come to find is you have to go back to the beginning, which each of the aggregates, and to understand and know their nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because in other words, if I would say to myself, of course, I know I'm not my body.
Yeah.
Intellectually attached to that.
Yeah.
But it's not going to leave me in a place where I still don't have that sense of yes.
Yeah. And I think that's really important in the sense of there is a certain intellectual framework that you set up, but that's not the point. The point is to be able to bring it back to experience. And of course, that's always the point of the Buddha's teachings. So it's how to bring it back to, or not so much how. We have to put forth the effort to bring it back to the experiential level. Pete?
If I understand it right, so anatta is a sense of like you rent something.
Yes.
It's kind of yours. But it's not accepting yours.
Yep.
So the body is mine. I use this body to walk, to talk, to do things. I take good care of it because I don't want to, pay later on, but still, I have to return this to something, to someone.
Yeah, which is exactly what, say, how Ajahn Chah put it, you know, in the sense of, he said, you know, when he called this, talking about in a discourse about our referring to our real home, and in terms of Dhamma, but then he said, you know, and pointed to and referring to, say, this body, this mind, this sense of me, said, yeah, we only rent this house, we don't own it, so that it goes back to nature. We don't.
So if it's the sense of the emotions, so you kind of acknowledge it, embrace, but you don't hold it tightly. Is that how?
Well, you also have to exercise discernment in, you know, what's useful, what's not useful. What's helpful to create well-being and peace and clarity. What is resulting in confusion, complication, difficulty. Okay. Manichai.
John, for the classes that I teach for UCLA, we use an acronym RAIN. I don't know if you've heard it. RAIN, recognize, A for allow or accept, I for investigate, and then N for not identify.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then, so it's often they get caught up, they get stuck with, what do you mean, another? I mean, these are not people who practically study Dhamma.
All right.
And so I've found a way to kind of explain it to them in a way that, okay, if you say, I am angry, when anger goes away, what happens to you? Do you disappear with it?
Right.
You know, so. If you say, I have pain, when pain goes away, what happens to you? And so they kind of, okay, they detach from it in that sense.
Right.
Or not take it personal, as if these things are happening to you.
Right.
And I say, I have, English is my second language, so I'm very careful about am, is.
Right.
If I am, then I am, I can't change it. so that helps them, but that's just shallow, you know, on the surface part of it.
But it's that actually, how do you say, conceiving of that as a possibility, and you start seeing it on ordinary things, smaller things, and you start realizing this applies to absolutely everything.
Hold on to sadness. I am sad, so what happens when sadness goes?
Neil.
So, I just want to make sure I got this straight.
Yeah.
The Buddha is not saying there's no self.
Right.
He's just saying, look at these things that we identify as self, and notice that they are not who you are. They do not make who you are.
Yeah.
And then in answer to Tim's question, you said, and if you keep looking, eventually you'll see there's nothing else but those things.
Yeah.
So if there's nothing else but those things, then there is no self.
Well, I mean, the thing is, this is true, but it's a logical deduction. And we're not trying, the point of the Buddha's teachings is not to sort of create an irrefutable logic. What he's trying to do is give you the tools to free the mind from its suffering. So that propping up an irrefutable logic is suffering. Pardon?
Isn't there then an implication that there is something else that could be self?
No, I mean, this is something that's plagued Buddhist theory forever, but it's just so important to make a choice between freedom, liberation, and getting something right.
My own sense is that it may run a bit deeper than that, in that
to someone who has actually experienced the world the way it is, like the way the Buddha is seeing things, even asking the question, is there a self, already appears, even to ask it is a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
You're already making assumptions by asking that question,
yeah,
which if you really understood, you would not make those assumptions.
Right.
And so,
yeah.
Especially the concept of self is a permanent, eternal thing.
Yeah.
By the time you ask that question, you're supposed to already know there isn't any absolute permanent existing. And I think the problem we all make is we're taught there is an heir successor to our thoughts, words, and deeds, right? Rebirth.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be a self that inherits that.
Right.
But we think there must be.
Well, see, that again, that's, well, because that's from our, say, from our own background, and, you know, the reality that the majority of humans' background, then that is the assumption, because it's the, you know, it's the most common, logical, and that's why, say, the Buddha's teaching is so unique, because he really is willing to challenge that incredibly deeply held belief, feeling, assumption of the who we think we are, what we identify with. Yeah.
Just paying attention to my own shifting from Western into Eastern thinking.
Yeah.
And the recognition that we're always, as Westerners, looking for the right answer.
Yeah.
Is to recognize, for me, there aren't any right answers, only right questions.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good. Because how we frame something is how we experience it. So learning how to frame it outside of that assumption of selfhood. Yeah?
I'm sure it's a very dumb question. Is the heir to my thoughts, words, and deeds, is that me or is that some other guy?
Well, it's not, neither. It's just an experience that arises and passes away.
We think it must be itself.
So
how can there not be a self if I'm reborn? But there doesn't have to be a self for there to be a recipient of your thoughts, words, and deeds.
Yeah.
It can be a separate, whole unrelated thing other than being the successor.
Yeah, I mean, it's a continuum of experience that arises and ceases. And the habit of the human mind is to create an identity around it. The tool that the Buddha is trying to encourage us to pay attention to is to pay attention to the experience. When we can tune into that, then we can relinquish, because we can have the experience, it arises and ceases, without the extra baggage of having an identity.
Is it good karma for smoke to come out of my ears?
I hope so. Kristen.
The fear that you mentioned upon some realization that there's nothing there is so strong and palpable that it takes away from the awareness of being able to stay with it. I was wondering if you had some suggestions.
I mean that's where that's where we start directing attention to Buddhanusati, Dhammanusati, Sanghanusati, like the recollections of the Buddha, recollections of Dhamma, recollections of Sangha, cultivations of loving kindness, and because those are integral to the Buddha's path, and they're there, or even the aspects of, say, like chakanusati, silanusati, the recollections of generosity, the recollections of virtue, because those tend to brighten and uplift the mind, and then it's done. Of course, it's done in conjunction with that recognition, because you see, the Buddha is always encouraging us to pay attention to that area of suffering and the ending of suffering. And when the mind is being overwhelmed by, say, by fear, then it's not going to get through it by analyzing it more. It needs to have a support to float it up so it can go, move through it. And so that as one starts to, and then even on, say, like on an intellectual level, we appreciate the clarity of the Buddha's logic, but emotionally it can be challenging, and that's where we gain that confidence in the Buddha's teaching. We look at it as a whole, and then there's this increased confidence in the skill of the Buddha, and pick up the tools that allow us to really maneuver our way through the experience of suffering, and to be able to free the heart from that, so that the different aspects of the teachings that allow the mind to be uplifted and clear. Okay, I'm going to move on here. There's probably no end to the questions. But the discourse of, and I think it's, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but the discourse is one where the, because the Buddha admonishes Rahula, then goes off and sits in meditation without going on alms round, and then Sariputta sees him and encourages him to the development of mindfulness of breathing, and mindfulness of breathing, as I say, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, is of great fruit and great benefit. And that's a very succinct sort of statement, but then you unpack that, and of course, mindfulness of breathing, as the Buddha taught it, really fleshes out the four foundations of mindfulness. So that, again, you're coming back to a practical tool of developing awareness. Mindfulness of breathing is it's the breath, but then it's the breath in association with the experience of the body, of feelings, of the mind, and of phenomena. So that it covers the range of how to bring the mind to a place of tranquility and insight penetration. So it's a full practice. And then the Rahula goes back in the evening after meditating through the day, meets the Buddha, and he asks him, how do you develop mindfulness of breathing? And I think one of the things that, especially with mindfulness of breathing and the four foundations of mindfulness, those four foundations of mindfulness are not just a tool to, say, have strengthened awareness, but they're a context for developing that awareness and mindfulness, which allows the mind to see things through the light of anatta. They're objects of mind. Everything becomes an object of mindfulness as opposed to an object of self, and that's really, sometimes that's not really emphasized so much. There's so much talked about being mindful and mindfulness, and it becomes a mindfulness technique, but the aspect of the corollary of that, or the necessary result of being mindful, is that you're seeing things through the light of anatta, of not self. But then the Buddha's again say when the Buddha's answer to Rahula with the how do you develop mindfulness of breathing so that it's of great benefit? He goes back to not self again, but he picks up the elements. So the question is, how do you develop mindfulness of breathing? And the Buddha goes to the elements. You go to earth element, water element, fire element, air element, space element. And whatever is experienced with that, that how we experience it's seeing it, and it should be seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is, with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element and makes the mind dispassionate toward the earth element. So it's like picking up those objects of experience again, and it's like Ajahn Chah, knowing and letting go, and seeing that through that light, so that there can be an experience of relinquishment and not self. Then those elements are then, the Buddha encourages them that using that contemplation to develop equanimity, so that stability, an even point, and of stability, equanimity, and then relinquishment, abandoning. And then then the Buddha goes back again to mindfulness of breathing, sort of explains it. So it's actually a very beautiful sutta. It's like segues in and segues out, but he keeps coming back to this point of developing that mindfulness as a basis of experience that we rely on, and it keeps coming back to not that experience of not self. Okay, we scheduled in a couple breaks today, knowing this is the sort of topic that gets smoke going out of people's ears. So we can have a short break, and then come back, and we'll carry on with another sutta.